Hello, thanks for being here. This is Margaret Malone, and you're listening to another episode of Bust the Canon, a literary interview series where we talk to writers about writers they love from the past, present, and future, the ones that are all too often lesser known than we'd like them to be, writers who are working outside the traditionally known literary canon that U.S. readers are familiar with. Today, we're talking to Melissa Ferrer-Seville. They're a Gnostic, first-generation Haitian-Cuban queer poet, organizer, and educator living on Ka, Oto, and Osage lands, otherwise known currently as Kansas City, Missouri. They're preoccupied with constructing new communication for the manifestation of a home we all hold in our hearts. Melissa has two chapbooks, Birthing Pains and Stenopad, both from Turnsoul Editions. Melissa received their MFA from Randolph College, is the director of political education and movement strategy at the Kansas City Defender, where she runs Be Real, Black Radical Education for Abolition and Liberation Academy, an organizing fellow with Decarcerate KC, and the first poet laureate of Kansas City, Missouri. Heck yeah. Melissa is the founder of the Abolitionist Arts and Organizing Event Series, A Nation in Exile, and is now a poetry editor with Turnsoul Editions. Melissa, hi.
What's up?
Thank you so much for being here. And I have to just say, you know, in the age where the words inclusion and equity are tossed around like just like whatever, like meaningless things or flags of advertising so corporations can go on about their business. Let me just say, reading your bio is so heartening because I know you well enough to know every single word of your bio is straight from your heart and action. And it makes me feel so happy and grounded to know you exist in the world and are doing this work from such a genuine place. So just thank you.
First of all, thank you for saying that. Also, I was thinking about like I as you were reading my bio, I felt my heart like very like widening. It was like pulpy, sweet, all of these gushy things. And I was like, does everyone feel like this when they hear their bio read? Because I was just like, yeah.
No, I don't think they do. I mean, who knows? I don't know. People are a mystery to me. I'll certainly say that. But I think I've said on the show before, one time I was doing an event and a poet was reading my bio. And then he just stopped halfway through. He's like, I just feel like I'm reading somebody's CV. And I was like, right. That is how people use their bios. They forget it's this opportunity to say, here's what I'm doing. And here's what you could be doing too. And let's do more together.
Yeah.
It's such a pleasure to have you on the show. I do, even though we're here to talk about other people, I do just want to hear a little bit about yourself. And I also really want listeners to know a little bit more about you and find out what you're up to. So what's going on in your creative life? What are you interested in right now? What's happening?
Funny enough, I'm usually a poet. I was just in Portland. We just saw each other very briefly for the McCormick Writing Center because I'm working on a memoir. So I'm working on, yeah. I'm working on, at first it was an essay because who am I to write a book, right? That is prose. It was supposed to be an essay on death. That actually started my final residency at Randolph, where I took prose lectures because I didn't have to take poetry classes anymore. So I was like, let me see what the prose people are up to. And I was actually in a lecture with Jane Wong. And we did this like time-based exercise where we wrote like a duration of time on a piece of paper and pass it to like our right or our left or something. And we had to write like a scene that happened that took the place of that duration of time.
Oh, that's cool.
And whatever the duration of time was that I wrote, or that I received, what I ended up writing was the scene, the memory of me walking from the elevator in the hospital, passing the waiting room and going into the bereavement room where my family was waiting to tell me my mother had died. And
My God.
Yeah. And so when I got back to Kansas City after that residency, after graduating, I kept writing into that. And then separately, I was like, watching documentaries and like listening to lectures of what I call Black luminary ancestors. So like James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, and things like this. And every time I would like engage with their work or their voices or their perspectives, I would suddenly feel the call to write. And it felt like they were writing right along with me, right? And like eking out this stuff that sat at like the bottom of my gut. And after a while, I realized that these like meditations or ruminations that ended up being obsessed with like institutions of oppression and the way that the allegiance to death and all of these things were in conversation with these now a multiplicity of anecdotes that I was writing, thinking about the deaths of my mother, my sister, my father, all these people who had died in my life. And I realized that they were speaking to each other. So I wanted to try intertwining these things. So at first it was just like an essay of like mini sections that went back and forth, an anecdote of a memory or a vignette into a moment that death visited me, and then these kind of like meditations and ruminations on death and oppressive and institutions of oppression. And it was actually going back to Randolph, visiting Randolph, where this past winter was I was talking to people about this project I'm working on, this essay, and I was like, yeah, it's about like, 45 pages long. And they're like, no, you're writing a memoir. And I was like, no, I'm not. Because I don't psych myself out, like I haven't ever like taken on a task like this of like the long project. I used to always say I'm a poet because of my attention span. And so and so it was kind of daunting to like admit to myself that I was like writing a book or a long project or anything like that. But now I'm like, especially after McCormick, I feel so secure in this project that I'm working on. And I've narrowed it down to like this elevator pitch of like, it's a braided essay with three strands. The first strand is a memoir of the times that death visited me in my life through the death of my loved ones and the death of myself through psychosis. The second one are ruminations guided by Black luminary ancestors on institutions of oppression and their marriage to death and how the fear of death is manufactured. And that manufactured fear of death is manipulated by the powers that be in order to get us to make decisions to betray our own humanity. And then the third one is research on Afro-Indigenous, Greco-Roman, and Abrahamic or Semitic death rites, practices, rituals, and afterlife beliefs. So that's what I'm working on. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you
Yeah.
for working on that. Where do I go with that? I'm so deeply interested in all of those things. And I want to just return for a moment to, so I've had my own season of death in the last couple months. A bunch of close friends have fallen in a really short period of time, all in really messed up ways. And I'm particularly in love with this phrase you used about moments that death visited me. Can you, what is, where did that phrase come from? What does that mean to you? And how did you arrive at this? And how is it, has it changed how you think about death or live with alongside death? Just let's talk about death for a second.
Yeah, oh, would we'll love to. I could talk about death for a very long time.
Wonderful.
I think I started using that particular phrase perhaps in 2020. When was that? 2023, 2024. There was like a month, it was August 2024, that death would visit me every morning, when I woke up. And, It was, and to explain what that looks like, one might say like suicidal ideation, right? But it didn't feel like that to me. Also, I just have like a very different relationship to the ways that I relate to my emotions. There's no such thing as a bad emotion. It all is just like information, and there's no such anything that is happening in my body is just a state of existence and of being that is transient, right? And so, death would visit me, which felt like my heart would get tight, and what one would call hopelessness would fill it. And anytime I would like look out in my mind's eye toward like what I'm going to do today or tomorrow, it was all blank. It was all black. There was no sense of a future, no sense of a moment beyond this moment of being in my bed, and like there would never come one, right? And in this process, when death visited me each morning, it would make a case for itself, right? It would talk about who in their right mind would want to live in such an evil world, right? Who would want to proceed on such a journey and a path through genocide, right? Through slavery, through exploitation, through extraction of every good thing from this earth and from the body and from the self. And like, and isn't it the most sensible thing? Is to die. It's to die right now, isn't it? Right? Even the Bible says to live is Christ and to die is gain, right? And so it would literally like just be making a case for itself. And I'd be like, you're right. And that's the thing. I didn't refute, right? I didn't refute death. Death had some very good cases. But the other thing about death, the nature of end is itself, right? Like, it is what it is, right?
It's a
So
closed loop.
that which ends ends. And so death would make these cases that I could not deny, right? And from my point of view, could not deny, right? And I would just say, listen, yeah, you're right, you're right. And then eventually those reasons would exhaust itself, right? Heard it all the way through, and this would happen literally every morning for the month of August. Heard it all the way through. And then it would stop. It'd be silent. And it'd just be like what I call dead space, right? Nothing coming in, nothing going out, just nothing, right? And then I would like, I literally had this motion with my foot where I'd pretend like I was, or imagine that I was like grazing the side of a blade of grass, right? Which is such a poet thing to do. Call shout out to Whitman or
So
whatever.
So poetic, like back through the ages, thousands of years back, they've all been doing
I would like imagine that I was like grazing the side of a blade of grass, and I would literally feel this energy enter through my feet and up into my heart. And it felt, and I would say it's like the spirit of flora, the spirit of nature, fauna, you know, these kinds of things. And it didn't speak, right? Which is what life is so knowledgeable about itself that it doesn't even have to speak, right? It just reveals, right? It shows, right? And the feeling that I felt in my chest was a deep knowing and a deep feeling of love, right? Just like pure love. And it brought memories of every connection, of every moment of love, of every clear encounter and engagement with that which is worthy of life, right? And that was all the reason I needed to get out of bed every morning, right? Oh, I live because love, right? That love is the only reason I'm here. That love is the only thing worth living for in this world, right? When it, in a world that everything, where everything is tied to some death apparatus, truly, right? From our phones to chocolate to whatever, right? Someone is suffering at the end of the other end of that rope and that chain. Love is the only thing that makes sense, right? And so I started utilizing that phrase when death visited me, retroactively as well, right? Where it used to be, I would say, every 10 years, ev or no, for 10 years of my life, every 2 years, someone I loved died. And then I started changing that to like when death visited me.
You're listening to Bust the Canon on X-Ray FM. We're talking to poet and community organizing heart in action, Melissa Furr Saville, author of chapbooks Birthing Pains and Stenopad, and recent and current poet laureate of Kansas City. Okay, so first ever poet laureate of Kansas City. I want to ask, if I'm doing my math right, this is the end of your tenure. You've got what, 6 or so months left in your tenure as poet laureate. I'm so interested to hear, what has the evolution of this experience been like for you? What are you focused on as this sort of first poet laureate coming to a close? Just like all the things of what it means to you to hand it off to the next person, and where is your heart and your mind at as this incredible tenure begins to wind down?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, when people, so I've been poet laureate, the entire term will have been 3 years. And at the beginning, people were like, what does a poet laureate do? And I'd be like, I, your guess is as good on the city website, it was like the poet laureate is an ambassador for poetry and the arts in Kansas City, right? And then I was like, okay, like on a word level, and I really resonate with the word ambassador because I actually come from a line of ambassadors, like in my like lineage, right? So I was like, okay, ambassador. I've done some work around that word. I have an understanding of that word, right? And then it was like, and I was like, oh yeah, and I'm in community with all kinds of artists, you know. I'm always connecting the dots between people, so beautiful things can happen in our city, like all of these kinds of things. But like still, it didn't like feel grounded in me for like what a poet laureate was, outside of the fact that when I received and for like when I received the news that I would be it was like Jacob's ladder on cocaine inside of myself, going up and down and up and down, you know, like the whole thing. So it was actually a few other poets laureate who like started to get my mind thinking about how to think about this position, right? So one of the poets, I'm pretty sure it was our Eris Keon, pretty sure. I was doing like a I was part of like a poet a Black Poets Laureate panel that was hosted by our good friend Maya Williams out in Portland, Maine, the other Portland.
The other one.
And I think it was Eris who said, like, you know, we don't get, or maybe it was Asia. That's the thing. It's either Eris or Asia. And I'm so sorry, y'all, if y'all hear this and you're like, we're not the same. I know, I know. Anyway, they said that, like, you know, we don't get the poet laureate title in order to activate anything, but because of what we're already doing. And that kind of like settled me. And I was like, yeah, at the time I was doing A Nation in Exile, still doing that. It's been on hiatus, but it's rejuvenating next year, which is really exciting. But yeah, I was doing A Nation in Exile, which is this arts and organizing event series that married like performance arts to organizing to get people connected to organizations that they most likely cared about because they showed up for this event, da, 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 all this stuff like that, and raise money for these organizations as well. And I was like, yeah, no, that feels right. That feels really right. And then I went to AWP in LA and sat and witnessed a poet laureate panel. And there were three poets laureate and three people who like make po or maybe two poets laureate and two people who like make the programs right in their city or made them. And one of the last minute additions, so I went on like principle alone. I was like, I need to figure out what a poet laureate does. But one of the last minute additions to this panel was a poet that I love named Tongo Eisen Martin, who is the poet laureate of San Francisco, who is like a semi giant in my eyes, right? Like I really admire his work, and not just because he's a poet, but he's also an organizer. And so I asked a question in that panel, and I was like, "Hey, Because he was talking about like Black freedom schools and stuff. I was like, oh, it's wild that you say that because I actually facilitate a Black abolitionist freedom school. And, I know that poets laureates are like laureate are supposed to like do these literacy projects, these literary things, do workshops around the city. Poetry is amazing. Everyone should write poetry. And just not feeling it. Like the world's on fire. And I'm an organizer and I feel really called to organizing. So I'm curious, as a poet and organizer who also held this position in your city, what did you feel your energy being called to? Was it these literacy projects, or was it organizing? And without missing a beat, Congo said, always be an organizer first because they're going to be an imperialist first. And I was like, my job, Mike Drop, I know my job. I know my job. And so I've been doing that, honestly. Like I've been, I'm a political educator. I run Be Real Academy. I organize with abolitionist organizations as well as like I'm on call for like on any of the organizations in the city that's like, radical knows that they could call me at any time and I will be there doing anything they need me to do. I've like organized with AIR. I've done as advocates for immigrants' rights and reconciliation here in Kansas City. There's currently now the Kansas City Community Defense Network, which is creating the rapid response teams in the city as a response to ICE, like all of the stuff like that, and that feels real and that feels correct and that feels true, right? Because I think it's Gwendolyn Brooks who said like living is the primary. It's what we do first, and the poetry comes second, right? It's the reality of I remember my first residency at Randolph. I think you were there for this residency when Kaveh was there and gave that lecture on the poet who the Iranian poet who went into the leper colony and made like that documentary about it. And like the thing that that left with me is that like poetry must walk off of the pages and into the streets, right? Like we don't become poets because we want to be rich. We become poets, most poets anyway, I know, right? And most artists even came through the art through their suffering, right? Because they needed some form of liberation. They needed to carve out a space for them in this world that was so inherently and deeply not for them, right? And they wanted to find themselves through it. And if and I think the best of us, and I'm putting myself in the echelon unabashedly so, and I think the best of us did not only want to find a through way and a way out for ourselves, but for whoever would come along, right? And so for me, it made sense that once I started organizing, once I found political education and doing this thing, the poetry would fall to the back burner, right? It was Tongo who told me that the title of poet laureate was act goes back to like empires of England and the English Empire, right? When a poet was so acclaimed that they would be adopted into the royal family, right? And that was the title. Yeah, that was the original use of the title of the word poet laureate, and that status. And I think about that a lot as I live and breathe and am in this position. And and I'll always be the first, which feels good. Not gonna lie, because of the ways that I feel so connected to my city, the ways that I feel on the pulse of what's happening in the organizing scene. Of what's happening in City Hall, of what's happening on the east side or the west side of Truce, of what, like the way also the city has grown me, literally. Like Kansas City is where I got my restart in life with nothing inside of myself and nothing but a backpack and a stuffed animal, at living at a homeless shelter, having exited a psychiatric ward. That's how I got to Kansas City, right? And so the city was really, and it continues to be the site of my becoming. And so, like, so to recognize and honor not in the like false sense of like what the kids say today, glaze, right? Not to glaze the city, but to truly honor the reality of what it has been, what it is urging to be, and all of the messy parts in the middle, right? And so I feel like passing on this baton, I have to say it with my whole chest, stand on any mountaintop, but probably not a mountaintop because who's gonna hear me up there, right? Like probably like, standing sitting at a table. I don't know. Whatever the people are, that's where I'll be. But like, and for anyone who is coming into this position after me, being a poet is not enough, right? Writing pretty words is not enough. What I think about anyone, a poet laureate, is the same thing I think about a poet, which is like, if you, what is your work doing, right? What is the impact of the work that you are putting out into the world? Is it trapping people in this messed up institution that we're in, or is it liberating them from it through granting them access to the keys that unlock the bars in their own mind, so they may see the true field of existence and the magnificence and wonder that it is, and feel incited not only to pursue that liberation in themselves, but to help liberate others out of the traps of this indoctrinated world that we live in, right? And then off of the page, are you showing up in City Hall? This whole thing, this whole shebang, is language. What do you mean writers are not in City Hall? What do you mean poets and wordsmiths and those who are so deeply attuned to meaning are not in the places where meaning is weaponized into making loopholes in order to get the way for billionaires rather than for the people? What do
Everywhere,
you mean?
all of government,
Everywhere.
legislature, court
Literally, it's all.
system, every police bureau, it's all language. Language.
Literally. So it is not enough to be sitting on my couch writing a poem. I gotta be in City Hall. I gotta be educating folks about this world we live in. I gotta do everything that I can with language and what I'm given in it in order to liberate folks, and speak truth. So that's what I think. That's what I hope that the next poet laureate after me understands, and the one after that. I mean, we are in Kansas City. We call it the heart of America. I say we're doing heart surgery,
Is that what you say? You are. We need it. We need it so bad. I just thank you. Like, I want to provide a stadium of people screaming and shouting for you, doing the wave to every word you just said. And all there is like subdued me in Portland, Oregon. But we need it so bad. And I feel so heartened and grounded and hopeful that there are people in the world who are living it in action and bringing it to be. It's just, thank you, thank you, thank you, one human to another, deep, deep gratitude.
Thank you.
You're listening to X-Ray FM. I am Margaret Malone, and this is Bust the Canon. Today, we're talking to poet and activist Melissa Fair Seville. Melissa was just telling us about being a poet laureate and rising to action and the power of language and moments that death have visited them. And now, let's do a hard pivot to the questions of others. Okay, so let's talk about some other writers. Who is, we'll get to the sort of first traditional question of the show. Who is someone that you feel like is sort of an overlooked writer from the past, someone who should have got a little bit more love than they did, that you want to share with us today on the show?
I'm so excited to answer this question. You think it's a pivot, but it's right in line with everything. So there's this writer who I recently, like in the past few years, only discovered through the poet Courtney Faye Taylor referring her to me, or for referring me to her work. She passed away, I think, in 95. Her name is Toni Cade Bambara. Now, I have to say, the reason I chose Toni Cade Bambara is because when I say her name, no one knows who I'm talking about, right? People know Toni Morrison. People know the misquoted the role of the artist is to make the revolution irresistible, or whatever, which comes from Toni Cade Bambara. But they don't know who Toni Cade Bambara was, or who she is, what she wrote, like all of these things, right? I have to say, I don't even know where to begin with Toni Cade. So Toni Cade is writing in the like 70s, 80s, 90s, 60s. She wrote The Salt Eaters, Gorilla My Love. There's a posthumous collection of her essays called Deep Sightings and Rescue Missions. She edited an anthology called The Black Woman, an anthology. She was an organizer. She was a documentary filmmaker. She was everything. She was amazing. She was Toni K. Bambara. And what was the wildest little fact about Toni K. Bambara that like relational fact as like to my discovery and like my obsession with her is that if I go online to try to find videos of Toni K. Bambara, I can't find them. I can't find her voice, right? It is only recently that stuff has started to come up because a friend of hers, and I don't know how to pronounce his name, so if he hears this in some off chance and he's like, that's not how you pronounce my name, I'm sorry, but I'm going to say perhaps Louis or Louis Messiah, who is a documentary filmmaker, wrote or did the documentary about the MOVE bombing called The Bombing of Osage Avenue in Philadelphia. Recently in 2025, released a documentary called Toni K. Bambara School of Organizing. And I haven't seen it yet. Shamefully so. We were working on bringing the documentary and the filmmaker to Kansas City. But yeah, Toni Cade is the reason I love her and everyone should know about her, or I want to tell everyone about her, is because there's like a series of writers that upon engaging with for the first time, and I do want to be very transparent here, right? And this is for all the girlies and boysies and theysies and themsies that like believe that who are like insecure about their reading habits, right? I have been through 10 psychotic breaks, and because of that, my brain does not function in the way that it used to. And part of the impact of that is like my ability to like stay in a book for a long time, right? I read much deeper than I ever have in my life, but I also read slower and I can't do it as long as I used to. I can't finish every book I read, you know? That is just sometimes I can, sometimes I can't. But and I'm healing and getting better, but that is my reality that I'm working with, right? And so my way of engaging with Toni Cade Bambara, yes, someone introduced her to me through a quote. She was like, "Oh, Toni Cade has this quote. Are you sure you want to be well, honey? A lot of weight when you're well, right? And like, or are you sure you want to be healed, right?" And she writes this in The Salt Eaters, right? And then I was pointed to this posthumous collection of essays and work of Toni Cade, Deep Sightings and Rescue Missions, that was actually put together by Toni Morrison, who was her editor at Random House. Yes, was her editor, and Louis Messiah, her friend and documentary filmmaker. And I felt so met, right? I felt so seen. I felt like my experiences, the way I live my life, the way I perceive life, the way I feel into things, the way I sense things, it was just so plainly put into to like of course, like it's obvious. Like I'm just talking about my experience. So the way Toni K. Bambara gave me permission to live according to my own sensibilities was deeply liberating, right? Because the way she lived and wrote and thought and function in this world according to her own sensibilities, the ways that she knew her shortcomings, what she was not good at, and the way that she knew what she was good at, because it is what it is and it be what it do, you know? And so like Toni Cade has been an agitational, active presence and force in my life since I have encountered her work, right? And everyone should simply just know that she exists, know about her work, read her work, watch the documentary, and also hopefully be changed in some significant way.
The phrase agitational active force is so good. I just feel like that is everybody's job right now.
Literally.
It's everybody's job.
Can I actually read this quote that I have pulled
Read
up?
it. Read it. Share it.
I recently had this article published in the Field Journal, which is like a journal of socially engaged art criticism. And it's the article is called "Wade in the Water: A Consolation on the Artist as Culture Worker and Practitioner of Fugitive Pedagogy." It's not as academic as it sounds. It is like, but I'm quoting a lot of people, and that's the only reason I'm talking about it, because I do think it's an article worth reading when thinking about the responsibility of the artist. And I'm specifically going to just read this whole quote. It's in a 1982 interview with Kay Bonetti. It's also in, I'm pretty sure, Black Women Writers at Work. When Kay Bonetti asks Tony Cade, "What do you view as the function of the artist?" Tony Cade responds, "The task of the artist is always determined by the status and process and agenda of the community that artist serves. If you are an artist who identifies with, who springs from, who is serviced by, or drafted by, say, a bourgeois capitalist class, then that's the kind of writing you do. And your job is to maintain status quo, to celebrate exploitation, or to guise it in a lovely romantic way. That's your job. If you are a writer in Cuba, post-revolutionary Cuba, your job is to celebrate the triumph of the national will. If you are a writer coming out of Kenya, the post-independent era in Kenya, your job is really to critique the failure of class struggle in Kenya and to tell the truth and to try to envision, to share a vision of what that society should be like if they're gonna really liberate itself. As a cultural worker who belongs to an oppressed people, my job is to make revolution irresistible." I just think that quote is one of the most horribly misquoted quotes I continue to see floating around the internet, and I think that the language of conditions is really important, and also like the ones that you might want to break out of too. Yeah, sorry.
No, I will like I want you to talk about that. The language of conditions is interesting to me. What, because I feel like that relates to the canon, which I'll get to, I guess, maybe later or now. But like, what does that mean to you? What does that phrase mean to you, the language of conditions? Talk about that.
Yeah, I think we try to like put this like broad stroke on everything. This is the way things are done, right? But the reality is, we are all in these bodies that are very limited, like in physical space and time, right? Like we're in these bodies with these perspectives, with these positionalities within a cultural context that puts people in certain spaces that has different sights and visions and ways of seeing the world because of what information we have access to, because of our access to relationship, love, the divine, whatever, whatever, whatever. And so, like, the language of conditions acknowledges the reality of the situations people are in. I really particularly, and the reason I read the whole quote is because, like the one that talks to the part that talks about, if you're coming from, and I think it's so important because, like, I think it's correct. And right, so if you're an artist who identifies with, springs from, who is serviced by or drafted by, say, a bourgeois capitalist class, then that's the kind of writing you do, right? I think that's really important because when we look at a lot of the people who got to survive the onslaught of violences to the archive, right? It is most often work that does not push up against in a very significant way the powers that be, right? And I am saying this about some of my favorite writers, mind you, writers that brought me into the world of writing, right? So it's not that their work is impotent, right? Because there's potency there. But I have to say that finding Toni Cade Bambara so late in life, one, is a blessing that I found her at all, and a shame that I'm just now finding her, right?
My brain is going so many ways right now. I don't know how to chase it and turn it all into a question, but I just this idea, I've never heard that quote before, actually. And it's so relevant to why I wanted to have this show. It's so relevant to if there even is a canon and why the canon is what it is. And also, it's so like I really like the discomfort of this idea of like, hey, acknowledge who you are, how you are, where you are, and where you're writing from, And you don't necessarily like, don't disown it, because even a platform that is imperfect and used, and like, yeah, you're coming from this particular situation, but it isn't impotent. It's still providing a pathway, but the cutting off of the reality of where we're coming from just leads to shame
Further exile.
and lying and pretending like we're not where we are because of why we're here, which is exactly how we are. What's are the world's on fire in the first place. So I just like, it's so liberating to me, that quote. I've never heard it before. I'm so excited. I will, for listeners, I will find that quote and post the whole thing. That book, Black Women Writers at Work, I have behind me on my shelf. I've never heard anyone in my life talk about that book before. So I was like, I wanted to jump up and be like, oh my God.
It's
anyway,
a good
okay.
one.
Thank you. It's a good one. Okay. You're listening to Bust the Canon on X-Ray FM. Melissa was just telling us about Tony Cade Bambara, which I will link all kinds of stuff to on the web page after this. So let's go to the second question, because I feel like I could talk to you for about 7 hours and then I'm going to get kicked off the radio station. But okay, so who do you feel like is an up-and-coming author or emerging? Again, these words are imperfect. Please do whatever you want with those and translate them as you would like. But who's someone who's writing now, or like gonna, who you feel like should probably get some love and we should know about as well?
For sure. So I was recently asked to blurb a poet's forthcoming chapbook. The poet won a competition through the Garden Party Collective, which runs chapbook competitions every year, and chooses four chapbooks each year. And the poet is a poet from Kansas City, or at least who I met in Kansas City a few years ago. And he reached out to me with like a really sweet, like, I don't know if you remember me, but like I've always been inspired by your work. And I won this contest, and I'm wondering if like you'll blurb the book and stuff. And let me tell you, when I open this, okay, I have to give you the full conditions, right? Because
Do the conditions.
the thing about conditions is it really gives the story and puts the meaning in everything, right? So it was like a day where I feel like I finally felt access to my creative, channels or
Right.
whatever, after like, having been in the political education and the organizing so deeply. We had just finished our third cohort of BeReal Academy. And so I'm like a writer today, right? I'm professionally a writer today, which is really moving. I'm just different things on different days,
I know.
And so I was going through like, okay, I've got a couple of, I've got a, because I'm also like volunteering as an a poetry editor at Turnsoul. So I've got a couple of like collections to read through and edit or like not, and I'm reading a collection and I'm like, oh, maybe I'm just like not into poetry today. Like maybe poetry is not just speaking to me because I'm reading like one of these things for Turnsoul. And then I'm like, and then I take a break, smoke my little cigarette and come back. And I'm like, I'm just gonna like dig into just start reading this chapbook by, oh, and I didn't say his name yet, did I? Let me say his name
It's
by
like a drum
Miguel's.
roll. Okay, sorry, say it again. Say it again. It's a lot of
I'm
lead
like, you're
in.
so good, you're so good. So I'm reading this chapbook by Miguel Santiago Flores, right? And the chapbook is called Out of This Soil, a Knife, right? Let me not mess that up because it could be from the soil and I would be wrong and I would be doing him a disservice. Yes, out of this soil, a knife, right? And when I opened that chapter and I start reading and I'm just reading, and I don't know if you have this experience reading words, but like reading is like eating to me, right?
Yeah.
Like I'm just like. Like, ominous. If this is not, and I think I wrote this in my blurb or whatever, this chapbook is the reason why I opened books in the first place, right? It's what I am looking for every time I open a book, right? It is the, and it is the the fight somehow pinned down to the page, right? It is the roar and the urge and like that which exists in the bottom of our guts when we stare and face evil that is in this world, right? And I like it is also a hallelujah. It is also a blessing. It is also a celebration. And that is expressed in forms. That is expressed in language. It's like I'm pretty sure there are raps in this. I was reading some of these from the raps. These are just raps. Like these are raps. These are, and like, which for those of you who are listening who do not know, rap stands for rhythm and poetry, you know? And so like the way that this poet Miguel reveals themselves on this page, in these pages, and not just themselves, but the struggle. They're Filipino writer, right? And whew, it's so good. And so I'm just, if I can, just read just two of these stanzas of a poem in this,
Do it.
is yeah, okay.
Do it.
An apocalypse is the powerhouse of the body. Life choosing to live in the midst of blood, kissing blood like rain, diving headfirst into oceans. And you tell me I shouldn't celebrate something so goddamn beautiful. When God said, "Let there be brown people," did you not hear the block party? Angels. Tripping, basement riots, next door neighbors set the whole garden on fire. We sampled the choir Salat to Allah. My cousin told me Jesus's new mixtape is hot. It is good. Freckles, birthmarks, half the size of my unbound heart. It is good. Two lungs, forgetting volume control. Good. Big mouth and loud accordion throat. Good. Big ass piano fingers. Big ass nose. Big ass small ass on a big ass small ass on a boy who don't know he's small. That boy, he's stepping just like his mama do. I think just like. And the way, like, I recently learned about this phrase or this concept from my mentor at McCormick, Wendy C. Ortiz. She talked about polyphonic voices, right? We were talking about, like, yeah, the polyphonic voice and how the canon, which we'll get to, like, praise the tradition is like a singular voice, right? The industry will be like, this is your voice, so that when readers pick up your book, they know what they're getting every time, right? But how she and also I like really lean into this like polyphonic way and nature of speaking that feels more honest, right? Because it's a response to a moment. It's also the recognition of what lives within, which is so much beyond our individual lives, given that we are all parts of lineages who have ancestors and also like becoming ancestors, you know, all of these things. So like, so there are many voices that can rise from one voice, right? And in this collection, that like polyphonic nature of the voice is really present. 'Cause like I read that, but that's not going to tell you about anything else. That's in the, you know what I mean? It's like it like I will tell you the whole thing is an oof. And I was someone said that recently and that made me laugh so hard. But like it's an opus that like that really like takes you on a journey and everyone should read Miguel Santiago Flores. Just yeah. So that's forthcoming from Garden Party Collective. Yeah.
All right, I'll definitely be getting that. That knocked me out. Thanks for sharing that poem with us. Okay, we got to get to the last question so I can get you out of here and go on to your important life business of being a human in the world. What are your thoughts about the canon? Is there a canon? Does it matter? What is it? How do you, what's your relationship to it? What's happening? What do you got?
So I'm also going to use this moment to plug Randolph MFA,
Please plug Randolph MFA.
because I have to say, I my first psychotic break was induced by the American white supremacist elite creative writing program academia of my undergrad, and because I came into academia having been a spoken word poet and was immediately met with spoken word poetry is not real poetry, you know, and then was like spoon fed all these like white dead male page poets and Emily Dickinson's of the world, which, mind you, don't, once again, don't get me wrong. I love poetry. I chose poetry because I love it. I have E.E. Cummings and Petrarch on my arm. Like, you know, I'm here for it. And
Right, damn.
I had a serious identity crisis, right? So much so that it split my mind in two, right? About and I mean Frantz Fanon talks about this with double consciousness, right? Just N.W.B. Du Bois, like literally this idea of the splitting that happens where you are presented with something that is not you and told that you are meant to be it, but you can never be, right? The canon, as we think of capital T, capital C, the canon, is one of the most violent and evil, I'll say it, evil things, concepts, ways that we move in this world, this idea of a standardization of anything in such a way that it's once again that broad stroke, that brush stroke on everything is killing so many people every day. Literally, when you look at a homeless person on the street, you can blame the canon, right? The thing I think about is Rand, the reason I'm gonna say this is like a little promo for Randolph, is Randolph was the first program that isn't it that it is an institution, right? But it was the first program that somehow communicated that I am the canon, right? That what I am trying to do is deeply necessary, deeply needed, and seen and felt and witnessed by others. And that those others wanted to pour into me so that I could grow into this thing that I'm already on the path to becoming. There's nothing I needed to prove. There are no metrics or standards or ways that I need to match myself to, but instead demand that I be met where I'm at, right? And I want to see like the idea of canon, right? Like I looked this up because I knew this was going to be a question. So I as a poet, it is my duty now, or but really it's just my proclivity and nerdiness to go look at the etymology of a word.
Me
And
too.
canon,
I love doing that.
it's just, you know, and canon, it's interesting because it's like a rule or a law, right? It's like, it's,
Yeah.
and I love this Greek canon, any straight rod or bar rule standard of excellence, right? This idea of like being straight. And I mean, I'm sorry for all the like traditional Christian people, but we live in a very queer world. Nothing's straight these days. And perhaps to be queer is the straightest one could be, is the most when we talk about like that uprightness of spirit, right? Making the way straight is like perhaps queerness, right? Is perhaps like this understanding that we are living a conditional existence, right? And to have, and to go back to that condi the language of conditions, right? That we live a conditional existence, that every person I meet, I must meet with a blank slate in my mind so I can witness who they are without a narrative overriding their existence in my mind so I can truly meet people where they are for who they are, right? And the canon and anything like it completely erases everyone. Even the people who have canonized themselves, right? Because now there is a structure that they must always adhere to, and any straying from such structure is because it is detrimental to this definition that has been given, will always now be a prison, right? And that's what I think about the canon. I'm just gonna be me. And if you like
That's
it and if
not
you
mean.
relate, that's it, huh?
That's not mean. That's not mean.
Just going to be me,
Oh,
right?
good. I was like,
Yeah,
that's not mean.
I'm just gonna be me, and if you like it and you vibe with it, then I'm for you. And if you don't vibe with it, I'm not for you. And that, trust me, is okay. If everyone liked the same thing, we'd be a very horrible place. I'm just saying. And yeah, I don't know.
This phrase of I am the canon, I just feel like perhaps I now need to have t-shirts that just Say that, and all writers who come on the show now need to be issued that t-shirt, because I think no phrase has really captured my thoughts and feelings about the whole thing more so than that. So thank you for uttering those words, and thank you
For sure.
for Randolph being the conduit anyway of how that came to pass, and even me knowing you and being aware of you and your work. I just thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, honestly.
I appreciate you. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your answers to these questions, your involvement in being a human being in the world, and your passion with meeting death waking you up every day of just with an open ear and still, nudging the blade of grass anyway and rising. Thank you. It's just been a delight and I don't know, empowering human moment. I so desperately needed this week to just talk with you and listen and have you share. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Can I get the last word?
Do it.
I just want to say, Margaret, that you are also an amazing human.
Thanks, Melissa. Love you so much. Thank you for being here. This is Bless the Canon. We'll be back next month, first Monday. Thank you so much. Thank you to X-Ray FM. Go be a human in the world, everybody. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.